Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Well, when you're a graduate of the Royal Veterinary College, the University of London, and have launched a thriving veterinary practice in Sydney, Australia in the early 1980s, and are recognised and respected as one of the world's leading natural feeding experts, then clearly you've earned the right to actually have some attention paid to your words. And when those words relate to the diet of our cats and dogs and so on, maybe we need to listen even more attentively to Dr. Tom Lonsdale, who joins us on the program today. Tom, how are you?
I'm very, very well, Alex. Thanks for inviting me. Wonderful
Excellent.
To be here.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self. And I was fascinated in terms of this particular research, and indeed your own research, which has demonstrated quite clearly that maybe the days for pre-packaged pet food should actually be approaching their end, really. I mean, this is tying in with multi-billion dollar pet food fraud, hiding in plain sight, and expose of the commercial pet food industry. Maybe, as I say, those wonderful soft pet foods aren't necessarily doing our feline and canine friends the best of work for their health, perhaps, Tom.
Quite right. They never were. They were never suitable. But by stealth, they were introduced way back. Oh, actually, they started off with biscuits. Jack Sprat in the 1860s, I think it was, during the period of the American Civil War. He concocted wheat for bringing dog cakes. That's what he called them at that time. And very soon he teamed up with a bloke called Charles Cruft of Cruft's Dog Show fame. Who decided that they would fabricate this stuff and sell it to an unsuspecting populace. They got in first, and they've been at it now for 150 years, but it's a con. It's a massive con.
Now, this is obviously one of the key aspects of your theory, of course, cybernetic hypothesis of periodontal disease in mammalian carnivores. I mean, breaking that down to simplistic routines, a diet of raw meaty bones would seem to be the ideal that we're looking for our pets, it would seem.
Yeah, absolutely. It's imperative. I mean, that's why the wolf pack will run 40 kilometers through deep snow in order to get their fill of raw meaty bones. They are craven to do that thing. At great cost to themselves and the risks involved once they catch up with the deer or the moose or whatever are getting kicked in the mouth. But they're going to still go in hard because it's so important for them to clean those pearly whites, the 42 in the case of the wolf pack, 42 teeth each wolf, and for the pussycats, 32. The same applies. Cleaning the teeth is the first imperative. Well, maybe perhaps not quite the first imperative, because the feeding frenzy, which is going to stimulate the brain chemicals, and that in turn is going to stimulate the immune system. Then they're going to clean the teeth. Then they're going to tell the stomach something's on the way down. So this is a process that they should be employing. All those carnivores out there in the wild are doing that, but virtually every domestic cat and dog is not. So straight away, they're sick. They're not well. They're not being provided with what they desperately need.
I mean, you've noted that commercial pre-packaged pet food lacks the required toughness and texture to clean and massage a dog's teeth and gums effectively. Is that simply a case of, well, doesn't that open it up for owners to actually get out their toothbrushes and start cleaning them individually?
Well, you might say that. But, you know, I'd then suggest to you, well, why don't you try it on members of the family first to see if it works, if it's an acceptable option. And of course, it's an absurdity. I mean, there's no way that you, even with a cooperating spouse, are you going to get very far with that. And find the time to do it thoroughly by comparison with the vigorous ripping and tearing and chewing necessary to initially get through the hide and then the meat, the sinews, and then crunch down on the bones. The comparison is ludicrous.
80% of dogs and 85% of cats by the age of 3 are affected by gum disease caused by the buildup of plaque and harmful bacteria. Is that directly related to the diets that they're being fed?
Oh, absolutely, because the diets don't clean that plaque off. And the plaque, of course, is a mixture. It's a wonderful ecosystem, actually, of bacteria and viruses and fungi and the like that live there undisturbed by the sloppy stuff out of the can or the biscuits that slide past the teeth and do nothing to clean them. So that builds up and builds up. But of course, it starts before they're 3 years of age. I mean, that's just what a certain group of researchers have said warrants consideration, that this periodontal disease at 3 years of age warrants clinical intervention. It starts way before that. They've had 3 years of suffering before they get to 3 years of age.
Now, we know that the pet food industry, as you mentioned, is a multi-billion dollar state of play from that point of view. Why haven't they actually decided to actually start providing something like raw meaty bones in their particular products to actually start addressing these issues? Or is the case of, well, some have, but they're being effectively squeezed out of the market?
Well, the multinationals that run this show, they've worked out that they can have central manufacturing bases, massive advertising budget, and then distribution systems. And it's highly suitable to mass marketing of the packaged product, which has an everlasting shelf life. Once you start talking about the natural food, well, of course, it doesn't. It lends itself to cottage industry, but not to multinational marketing. So that's primarily the reason. A lot of them are get-rich-quick merchants who've now decided to say, well, the dried and the canned stuff is unsuitable, so we'll mince up some meat and put it in a package and say that's raw and natural. Unfortunately, it's not. It's not raw meaty bones, and so it lacks the texture. So you're back to needing raw meaty bones.
On that basis, Tom, for owners, and we believe that they are seemingly a growing number of people who are obviously taking a vegan or vegetarian lifestyle, and they say, oh, we want to adopt this for our pets as well. Are they basically being guilty of actually abusing their pets by actually trying to force them down a vegan or vegetarian lifestyle without these raw meaty bones?
Oh, look, I wouldn't seek to condemn those folks who are wanting to do better for their pets. The truth is that the canned and the dry is just as bad or maybe worse, because the people who can the stuff and bake the biscuits, they're aware of the science behind all of this. They're aware of the periodontal disease and the gastrointestinal upsets and the variety of diseases that follow on. So vegans and vegetarians who, understandably, they think, well, you know, if that highly processed stuff in the can and packet is suitable, well, can't we now use a bit of ingenuity and do our own thing? No, it's all to do with lack of leadership by the veterinary elite, who should have been showing leadership from the very top and telling people, no, raw meaty bones is the essential for these carnivores. And then the vegans and the vegetarians would get some sort of signals, some signposts, some directions.
Is this analogous to the junk food industry for human beings, in which we have growing levels of obesity and issues related to that and poor health because of the junk food that's out there? Is this the pet industry's version of junk food for our cats and dogs?
Well, Alex, it would be easy for me to say yes. But in fact, I'd like to go further than that and say, OK, let's take McDonald's as a staple junk food. I mean, we all acknowledge that that is the case. And nobody would feed their family breakfast, lunch and dinner on McDonald's. But now take McDonald's, for instance, and you just tip those three meals into a great big cement mixer, mix them all around, tip it out, dry it, chop it up into little biscuits, put it in packets. Would you ever, ever, ever consider feeding that to the family every day, every week for life? The dried up McDonald's in everlasting packets? I think not. And that, in fact, is what's happening for the carnivores. So the stuff for the carnivores doesn't even start out as raw meaty bones, the natural food of the carnivore. It starts out as grains, rice, maize, wheat, barley, oats, maybe some peas, and a whole lot of supplements. So this stuff that the dogs and cats are required to survive on is far worse than junk food for humans.
No, I see far that. Worse. In one sense, you talk about raw meaty bones from sources such as whole chickens. I was always under the impression, or maybe it's an urban myth, that actually dogs could actually choke on chicken bones. And the last thing you should do, it's the equivalent to giving them chocolate, basically. The last thing you should ever do is to actually feed them chicken. Has that changed now?
Well, the thing is, another of these myths, really, and of course that grew up in the days when the only chicken consumed was at Easter or Christmas, and it was cooked, and you were not about to give the uncooked chook to the dog or the cat. That was a precious morsel for the family, and they might have tossed the cooked bones out. So certainly the cooked bones tend to splinter and can get stuck and do untold harm. Even the raw bones can, if, for instance, they're cut too small, and an animal will just slurp them down and get them stuck somewhere. So, yes, I mean, look, raw meaty bones are the food and medicine for the carnivores. And we know that if you're handling medicine, well, you've got to handle it right. You've got to administer it right. So a certain level of understanding, education's the key here. Ideally, you'd feed your dogs, your modified wolves, with chickens complete with fur, feathers, and entrails. That would slow them down. That wouldn't get any bones stuck. No way.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, in an ideal world, you're probably absolutely right. But I mean, if we add to that pigs' heads, fish, ribs of lamb, and so on, now the average urban city dweller is, or even suburban city dweller is, with a pet, etc., is unlikely to necessarily have easy access to that. So, what's the solution, Tom? I mean, can people actually easily access sources of raw meaty bones, or is it a case of no? You need to actually sort of invest in some fish, ribs of lamb, or various other aspects as well for your pet.
Okay, well, in the here and now, the answer is yes, but it might take a little bit of investigation, a bit of experimentation, ingenuity to find sources. However, take your small dogs and cats, chicken wings, chicken necks, whole fish. In this country, I think you can get rabbits in the butcher shop and so on. These are available and cheap. A 5 kilo dog or a 5 kilo cat would need about 1 kilo a week. Cost you very little. It's available right here and now. Most people have quite small dogs. People with big dogs, that might be different. And then they can go out and get some roadkill.
And is that, in a sense, the solution that, you know, if people are listening to this, who basically say, okay, for the, let's say, pet chihuahua or indeed feline friend and so on, you just actually sort of say that you have some roadkill. I mean, if they've been kind of used to obviously the junk food option, etc., might they not just turn their nose up at it and actually say, what's this?
Yeah, good question. Right, okay. Dogs, for the most part, will host straight in. I mean, they realize they sniff maybe a bit, lick here and there, and then seize and get into it. Some little dogs don't. Sometimes, you know, they've been, become addicted. Cats, certainly, adult cats often are addicted to the wrong stuff, and it takes a bit of changing them over. We've got lots of information on the website, so people don't need to be feeling alone in this venture. That they should go and do some research and find out how this is to be done, and simply going to www.thepetfoodcon.com, the answer's all there. And, of course, you then go to the YouTube channel and all the videos. We've been doing this for 30 years, don't forget. We would be doing it still if it wasn't so vitally important.
I mean, I was going to say, obviously, as we head into the 21st century, do you sense that there is a shift in people's attitudes? Or is it a case of, well, we've got our YouTube channels and we've got our websites and so on, but that is small potatoes when it comes to the armory of some of the marketing arms of some of the pet food manufacturers?
Well, you're right. You're right. If nothing changes, but I think when the first pebble rolls down the mountainside and triggers an avalanche, and when all of those big companies find themselves in court facing off against accusations that they've knowingly, deliberately marketed unsafe, unsuitable products under the guise that it's the best that you can possibly get, then maybe things will change. I think, you know, the public have been vulnerable. They've been exploited. It's their money that's used to pay for the advertisements.
100 years or so ago, the likes of Edward Bernays were employed by the tobacco industries to actually get more women to smoke cigarettes because it was seen as a wonderful, healthy opportunity. It was a cure for nerves, it was a cure for anxiety, and so on and so forth. Do you feel that actually this scenario of the pet food has got something in common with respect to the way in which tobacco, which for a certain period of time was being sold and marketed as a health item, is actually anything but?
Oh, quite right. Was Mr. Bernays a doctor? Was he a medical man?
He
The
was a he
sad.
was a, he was a sociologist and psychologist who adopted the notion of psychology
Okay.
to apply to the way in which people's behavior worked.
Well, that's right. So, talking about psychology, and I noticed there at the Lincoln School that you've got a school of psychology.
We do.
Right. This is extraordinary that the entire veterinary profession. Almost the entire veterinary profession is behaving as Mr. Bernays, recommending hugely harmful products as being the best available, and at the same time dismissing the natural and denigrating the natural as being unsuitable. Although, of course, when they come to zoo animals, the wolves in the zoo and the wild cats in the zoo, well, they're prepared to feed them raw knee bones. But not as soon as they become modified and step outside of the wire enclosure.
The old challenges of domestication. Tom, would you like to share with us the website again in terms of where people can find out more details about this wonderful campaign?
Good on you, Alex. Yes, please. Okay, www.thepetfoodcon.com. Or that people can just Google my name, and almost certainly, there's a few links there because we've been at this for a long time. And we so want to share the message. It's so uplifting. It's extraordinary when you hear and see an animal crunch through its dinner. It changes the animal owning experience almost totally. You get a new realization, brings you closer to nature, and the people who do this start to take more care of their own teeth and gums. They start to think more about their own diet when they see just the impact it has for their pets.
Well, some fascinating aspects that you've raised there, Dr. Tom Lonsdale, world-leading vet, as we said. Huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Good on you, Alex. Thank you.
Well, thanks to Dr. Tom Lonsdale there, a veterinary expert who insists that actually to keep our pets healthy, we should be feeding them fresh, meaty bones. That clearly ties in with our next awesome author of the week, who's joining us now after a gap of, well, a couple of years since he last was actually with us, specifically Friday, April the 16th, 2021, when, of course, we were delighted to welcome from Canada the creator of Spell Singers, Slingers, I should say, Spell Slingers, and a whole heap of other goody things, including, of course, the wonderful Squirrel Cat, who even 2 years later still goes down as the legendary Squirrel Cat. And creation of no less a personage than Sebastian de Castell. How are you, Sebastian?
I'm terrific. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back on the program, of course. And 2 years, it's almost as though the pandemic never happened. Here we are, kind of connecting in all sorts of ways, but still using the magical wonderment of Zoom to actually connect. So good news there, at least.
Thank goodness for Zoom. I think it got all of us through the pandemic in various ways.
Yeah. Now, as on your first show, we talked about your influences, thoughts about Ursula K. Le Guin, how that was being manifested, and so on. Let's jump straight into the action with, of course, your latest offering, which I suspect might be just a slight riff on the Magnificent Seven, or maybe even the Seven Samurai of Akira Kurosawa. It certainly has already engendered the following response from Nicholas Eames, a masterful blend of unique. Of wry humor, elegant prose, wonderfully imaginative world building, and of course, as James Lovegrove for the Financial Times would say, vigorous and action-packed. There's no way you can read this book without a grin on your face. So, first of all, am I actually correct in assuming there was a connection with the Magnificent Seven, or is it just a case of no, it's just world play?
Yeah, I'm convinced there is a connection, and that And that Kurosawa ripped me off, 70 years in advance, which is, a talent itself. But still, I think he should, be a little bit ashamed of that. I think almost all fantasy authors at some point have a secret desire to write The Magnificent Seven with wizards. And I know a great author, Cameron Johnston, around the same time. In fact, his book came out before mine. It's called The Maleficent Seven. I think the Malevolent Seven is a finer title, but we can disagree about that. But he too is sort of exploring that terrain, and there's just something wonderful about the watching the recruitment of a group of sort of anti-heroes, old Wild West style, and then taking them forth, but introducing sort of magic into it. And so that thread is there. The plot, of course, is completely different. But those inspirations are definitely there. So you well spotted.
Absolutely. I mean, just the opening lines from the publicity blurb here. Picture a wizard. Go ahead. Close your eyes. There he is. See? Skinny old guy with a long, straggly beard. No doubt he's wearing iridescent silk robes that couldn't protect his frail body from a light breeze. The hat's a must too, right? Big floppy thing covered in esoteric symbols that would instantly show every other mage where this one gets his magic. And again, that's the wonderful craft that you've put together, Sebastian. It's the kind of magic that instantly creates a backdrop for myself, which is basically an autumnal scene of the Burtis backyard in North Carolina, which clearly, I know we're supposed to be in May, but, frankly, it's almost like the autumn again. Jessica Burtis, welcome back to the Midweek Drive, author of the week. Have you got any questions for Sebastian de Castel?
Yes, I do. I'm actually really curious about, have you grown up reading books about magic? What made you choose fantasy to write about?
I think for me, fantasy was something that I was drawn to quite early on, certainly. I guess I should, I have to blame my eldest sister. My only sister, but my elder, significantly superior sibling. She read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to my brother and I when we were both little kids. Our father passed away quite early in our lives. So I was nine when my dad died. But he was, of course, quite sick before then. And so our sister had brought us to England, in fact, for a trip. We lived in Montreal at the time. And she brought us to England and read that book to us. And I think that just, I spent, most of the rest of my life looking for Narnia. And you find little bits of Narnia, of course, everywhere in the world, don't you? And so you start exploring that world internally, and that kind of brought me to magic and fantasy and writing those kinds of books, anytime I could.
And how do you go about building a magic system for your books? Because I know that can be very individual to different fantasy authors.
That's a really good question. And Malevolent Seven, of all the books I've ever written, has by far the most magic systems. There's a dozen different magic systems referred to in that book. And that's just part of the nature. I wanted, the parallel with The Magnificent Seven, of course, the idea of the seven gunslingers. You kind of want that. But when you're dealing with wizards, you don't really want them all, packing the same revolver, so to speak. And so I kept finding myself just relishing the process of going, right, here's this new character. What's their bag of tricks? But there has to be a coherency. There's a lot of different types. I think there's Brandon Sanderson who likes to sort of refer to hard magic systems and soft magic systems. And, I've never totally agreed with that, because when we talk about hard magic systems, we're often talking about things that it's like reverting to Newtonian physics. Like, they sound logical, they make sense to us, and therefore we're saying that they're sort of more sort of scientistic, I would say, rather than scientific. But in fact, they make no more sense than anything else. And so for me, what I try to do is I try to preserve some of the, if for want of a better word, the magic around magic, keeping it from feeling like it's too mechanistic, but at the same time having a rationale for it. So with the Malevolent Seven, I was reading a book on physics a while back that was sort of talking about how, the properties of our universe don't just include space and time and things like that. It includes the laws of physics themselves. And in other universes, those laws might operate differently. And so with the Malevolent Seven, the idea of the way all the magic emerges is Basically, a spell is a momentary breach between the mortal realm, between our universe and another universe where the laws of physics are different. And those laws, in effect, leak out momentarily. And so depending on which plane of reality a wanderist, which is a mercenary mage in this world, is attuned to, that's the kind of magic they get. So if you're a tempestoral mage, you're attuned to the tempestoral plane, which is non-stop storms that are affected by thought. You create that momentary breach and boom, now you're wielding a lightning whip for a moment. Or if you're attuned to the totemic realm, which is one in which the laws of physics keep make animal forms conceptual rather than purely physical, now you're drawing on the abilities of a particular animal. In the case of Aridaeus, the dashing, swashbuckling totemic mage in the Malevolent Seven, it happens to be the magic of that noblest of all creatures, the rat.
If you had to pick one for you yourself to use, which would you pick?
Definitely portalist magic. So the portalist realm is one in which there is no three dimensions of space. And so a portalist, when they create that breach, they basically create a key that in effect opens a door, and that door goes to wherever that key is aligned to, regardless of how far away it is. And so I constantly live with a desire for a set of keys that would include, you know, a key to Paris, to Cairo, to Cape Town, to Hong Kong, all these wonderful places. If I could have portalist magic, that would be the one I'd go with. Also, then I could run away every time I ran into trouble.
Thinking ahead, always important. I noticed that, again, if we look back in time, and we know time is just an illusion, to that awesome day when you made your debut for Siren Radio and Southside Broadcasting as our Author of the Week in 2021, as we said, Friday, April the 16th. We talked with Jessica about censorship in Russia, the art of fantasy writing, and a whole heap of other things. But since then, of course, Jessica has not only graduated from her first degree, she's up sticks and moved over to Dublin, where she's just actually in the middle of wrapping up her master's degree. And Jessica is in children's literature. So I like to feel in some way Sebastian might have inspired you in terms of that to actually do a full academic study of the whole thing.
I'm always inspired hearing these stories because this is what I want to do. I would love to have these stories in my head on paper and have others reading them. That's the dream.
So, Sebastian, what advice can you give young Jessica, a young aspiring fantasy writer doing her master's in children's literature at Trinity College Dublin?
Get writing. There is nothing that you lack. There is nothing missing from you. This is true of all of us as writers. Storytelling and language, and therefore writing and literature, are one of the great inheritances that we all share, and we should guard it jealously. And so I often tell people that there's often a sense before you write your first novel, or even after you have, but before you sort of try to write the one that you're really going to kind of go with, this sense of, well, I'm not sure if I'm ready, if I just learned more, maybe if I buy more craft books and take more courses. Craft books are lovely and courses are wonderful as well, but there's a compromise, a sacrifice that you make, that we all make in doing that, that I made, earlier in my career, which is there is a book that you can only write now. There is a book that is a wonderful book that will have all kinds of fabulous features. It will have flaws, but will have magnificent things about it that you can only actually write now. And as you progress, as you become, as all of us become more sophisticated in our writing and have a wider palette of tools, we can write other books, but that book doesn't get written. I'll give a parallel. I have a friend of mine who, I think at the age of 60, decided to take up the bass and start sort of just playing for fun with bands. And I said to him, have you started songwriting yet? And he said, oh, you know, no, of course not. I just don't know enough. I don't know any songwriting theory. I don't, you know, I'm not even particularly adept with the bass yet. And how do you write a song on the bass? And I said, there is a song you can write right now. It's the one where everything's there. And because he's a brave fellow, he went out and did it. And he wrote this song that's this very fun sort of punk song, and it's delightful, and it's a song he will not be able to write later on, because once he learns, you know, more chords, more shifts, more, you know, and that's true of all of us. So my biggest advice is, yeah, if you have those stories in your head, you go with them, you write them as boldly as you can. You never ever think about whether your not unique enough, or something is too cliche, or are people sick of sparkly vampires? People are not sick of sparkly vampires. I may not like them, you may not like them, anyone, but they are wonderful. And the only way that you can ruin sparkly vampires is by making them not sparkly enough. If you feel that passion, you know, that's what you go for. So that's a bit of a rant. I apologize. I'm sure you don't need any advice from me, but that is the one thing is it's already there. And there is a book that can only be written by you and can only be written by who you are right now. And that book is almost certainly worth the effort and worth the read.
I appreciate that a lot. I think that's a very good point. I think sometimes it's so easy to be intimidated by the success of established authors that you kind of feel like you can never get there. But it's, I think, yeah, good to remember that every author started there at some point.
I'll tell you a secret. Established authors are intimidated by debut authors because we know that publishers, even when you're relatively successful, I've been incredibly fortunate to be successful as an author. My books have been translated into 15 languages. I've made a great living for, you know, the 10 years since I've been doing this. But we know that publishers are always going, yeah, but maybe Jessica's gonna, maybe that's the book that's gonna really explode onto the market. And as authors, yeah, we wonder that too, whether, you know, because we don't, in fact, I was just talking to a really great author friend of mine, the legendary C.C. Humphreys yesterday. And we were talking about the how do you go back? How do you go back to that who you were when you were writing that first book? Because he was very successful with his first book. I was successful with my first book. And you change over time. So it's okay to be intimidated, but you should know that it's like you walking up to the cave with the animal inside. The animal is equally scared of you. So, you know, no worries, venture forth.
That's a good point.
As we speak at the present time, we are literally hours just after the release of The Malevolent Seven, released, of course, to the world on May the 11th of 2023. So I'm going to ask the question now, Sebastian. Cade Ombra, how much of Sebastian de Castell is Cade Ombra, and how much of Cade Ombra is Sebastian de Castell?
That's an excellent question. In fact, I get asked that quite frequently. I used to get asked about Falcio Valmond, of course, the hero of the greatcoats, who's a, you know, very troubled, swashbuckling hero, very idealistic, but worried about the cynicism of the world. And I would ask, you know, do you sort of write Falcio to be yourself? In fact, I mostly wrote Falcio to be, you know, who I more wish I was. But in fact, the author is all the characters. Every character in there is the author, and is a part of us. And so absolutely, Cade is part of me. And one of the great things about writing a novel, and one of the reasons why I think everyone should write a novel, all literate humans should write a novel, we all have a story in us, is that it is as much as anything a process of self-discovery. And I don't mean that in a very passive sort of new agey sort of way. What I mean is that you never know what you're writing about until you hit the end of the book. And one of the things I realized as I was writing the end of this book, that's about seven anti-heroes who all are pretty much convinced that they're the bad guys. And we live in a world now where we're dividing everyone up into good guys and bad guys, so to speak. And I'm using guys in a gender neutral way here as much as I can. And a bad guy is anyone who's done anything bad at any point in their life. And once you discover that, well, now they're basically a bad guy. And I sometimes wonder what happens to us when we convince ourselves that we're all bad guys, that we've all failed, that we're all broken, that we're all inadequate and largely unredeemable. And because the world kind of actually needs us, doesn't it? The world needs us to do things. Other people need us to do things. They need us to be ourselves. And in The Malevolent Seven, these are seven characters who have gone, you know what, we've all done some bad things in our past, so we're the bad guys. So there's no point in trying to be the good guys. No one's ever going to think of us that way. We may as well just, you know, live our lives as best we can. And but of course, they run into a situation where there are no good guys to solve this cataclysmic problem that's coming. And so they're forced to sort of step up. And in the case of Cade, he has this habit. He's constantly reminding himself and constantly reminding us that he is, you know, is one of the bad guys. He's not one of the good guys. He's failed that. And it made me realize how much that action of that self-deprecation, of which I'm often guilty, can serve as a way of eliminating responsibility and saying, you know what, this has got to be somebody else's problem because I'm not a good guy. I'm not altruistic. I've had all these failings. And so the part of Cade that is holding him back sometimes from stepping up to be the person he needs to be, that I didn't know was so prominent in myself, but Cade taught me that it's there, because once you finish that book and you get to the end, you realize, oh, that's what I was really writing about. I was writing about how if we decided that the bad guys can never be the heroes, and we keep telling ourselves that we're all the bad guys, then there's going to be no heroes left.
Profound words indeed, Sebastian. Let's move slightly now to the notion of the business of being an author and such like. And we spoke, obviously, at the height of the pandemic. That's now gone. We're getting interesting views from agents, certainly this side of the Atlantic, that smaller book festivals are not necessarily being treated as positively as perhaps they used to be pre-pandemic, that actually if it's more a case of they want the big festival, the Hay on Wye, somewhat slightly smaller, the Newark Festival, which launches obviously in July, maybe sort of agents are saying, well, what's the sort of angle? What are your own views as an author? Do you like to get out and about and actually meet people in person? Or is it a case of, no, just syndicate this interview and then I'll get on with writing my book?
As I mentioned to my publishers, I'm coming out to the UK on May 25th, where I'm going to be at Fantasy in the Court at Goldsborough Books, and then I'm doing the MCM Comic Con, and then I'm going up to Edinburgh for the Cymera Festival. As I tell my publishers every single time, you can book me at three festivals a day, every single day. I will never get tired of it. I will never say no. It's an unimaginable privilege when you're there, and it really feels that way. It's so rare in our lives that you get to go somewhere and people are excited just because you happen to show up.
You're a creator, Sebastian. You're a creator. You've brought the world the squirrel cat. I keep coming back to this. You know, the classic.
My greatest invention, certainly the squirrel cat. It's fun. And as long as you remember that there's a degree to which it's a sort of a pantomime, we're all equal human beings of equal worth, but everyone is momentarily pretending that you're extremely important. And your role at that point is to try to speak to their interests that you happen to have touched on in your writing. So I love it. I don't get invited to nearly as many festivals as I would like to go to. And I'm never quite sure. I was in fact talking to a publicist friend of mine, you know, and sort of going, how do you do you have to just find every single one and ask every single one? I think it's more, I am sometimes, to be honest with you, more troubled with the big festivals because as the Society of Authors, that great British institution, has indicated in the past, these are these big festivals that charge people sometimes quite a bit of money to go. And then they pay the caterers and they pay their directors and they pay, you know, and they pay everybody except the author. And the authors are the people that ostensibly the people are paying ticket prices to come and see. When it's a small festival and there's no money and everybody's just holding together by their teeth and volunteerism, I have no problem with that. I'm happy to volunteer too. I'm less keen when I feel like this is a big business. And they're simply saying, oh, you know, we can get the authors for free. And that's not always true. But honestly, I almost never know. I remember I was at the Edinburgh Festival, Literary Festival, a few years ago. And I remember I was doing a couple of YA panels. And one of the reasons I wrote Malevolent 7, by the way, is I had just finished writing the 6 Spellslinger books, which are young adult. And so you're not allowed to have much swearing. So I'd like to reassure all your listeners that Malevolent 7.
Profanities abound.
More profanities per page than almost any other fantasy novel. So that's quite an achievement. But when I but when I was at this festival, and I swore a little bit because I have a tendency. I love swear words. I love when you use them exactly right, at the right moment.
Sadly, the rules of British radio prevent us from actually going too much into that, but we understand.
I appreciate the warning. Don't worry. There will be none. I left them all in Malevolent 7. I have none left. But I had sworn a little bit at this for fun at this interview, but there was lots of school kids there, as it turned out. And so I was summoned to the author center, the green room, which was actually called the author yurt at the time. And I thought, oh, wow, I'm really going to get it now. And then I walked in, and they said, and they just handed me an envelope. And I thought, right, this is a little thick. These are legal papers. I opened it up, and it was a bunch of money. And they said, yeah, we weren't sure how to pay you, so here's your speaker's ffees. And it was something like £500. And I was like, wait, you flew me up here, you put me in a hotel, and
That's
like, did you
effing
want me to go get
unbelievable,
you?
you might have said.
I know. I thought, do you want me to go get you drugs? Is that what they, maybe you've misunderstood the nature, the hidden themes of my work. And they said, no, that's the speaker's fee. And I thought, wow, isn't this wonderful? And so you literally never know as an author. There are some events where literally they expect you to pay for your entry fee, even when you're a speaker. And
Yeah,
some
I'd
very
avoid
big
those, Sebastian, to be honest. I think it's important that we avoid that. And obviously, advice for Jessica, don't go into places where you're expected to actually pay an admission, but it's not good.
No, small festivals can be wonderful. We need more of them. We need more niche festivals. We need more ways for people who love books, whatever those books are, to feel at home and to feel as if they, as readers of something they love, are at the center of it. And we authors are coming in to help create that experience. So I'm all in favor.
I shall certainly address that with the founder and creator of the Newark Book Festival, Sarah Bullimore. Who knows, maybe 2024 we can welcome you to Newark near Lincolnshire as opposed to Newark, Nebraska, which is always important. Let's talk music, because I don't think we really addressed this in your first interview, Sebastian. Some authors have playlists. Some authors are locked into a particular form of music, a genre. They can't produce their work unless you actually have Wagner's three-ring cycle going in the background or other aspects. Do you have anything from your own perspective which you think, yeah, I need to have Elmer Bernstein playing the Magnificent Seven on loop in order for me to really feel the notion of the Malevolent Seven?
Every book is very different. I think, yeah, a little Sergio Leone music always helps when you're writing something that harkens to the Magnificent Seven. Trader's Blade, of course, was absolutely the product of a playlist. So I hadn't even been planning on writing a book, but I would go running all the time. I'm an absolutely terrible runner, and I find it dreadfully boring and painful. But I would listen to music, and I would find these pop songs, and I would listen to a song, and then it would kind of spark something in me. And then I would just play that song on loop over and over as I was running. And I would get a scene out of that somewhere. The thing about music is entirely designed to spark emotion, not simply sort of intellectual sort of exercises. So when you kind of compose a scene in your head to music, you're being guided by the emotional path of the song itself. And so that was very, very important to me, and having been a musician myself. But yeah, I still I can't hear there's a song, it wasn't very popular at the time. It's called You Know My Name by Chris Cornell. It was the theme song from
Casino
Casino Royale.
Royale.
Yeah, and that plays an absolutely integral role in Traitor's Blade. In fact, if you read the scene in Rijou, before the Blood Week begins, when Falcio is in this sort of standoff with these soldiers who are waiting for the clock to strike so that the fight can begin, there are lines that are not pulled from that song, thankfully, because God knows we've had enough copyright lawsuits in the world recently, but
Look, Ed
inspired by.
Sheeran's having to cope with it. He's just trying. That's all. He's an
He's
Ipswich lad.
hey, you know what? He's fighting for all of us. Thank heavens for Ed Sheeran. So there's scenes in there that are pulled, that are driven by that song. There's a line that people quote from Traitor's Blade, "No man breaks the rock," which it comes from the line, "I'll reach the rock," which Ralphie literally says, which is a song by Havana 3AM, which was a band from the 90s. They had this one hit song called "I'll Reach the Rock" or "Reach the Rock." So music can play a huge role in that. And sometimes it works the other way around. Sometimes you're writing a scene and you think, I need something to kind of help give me flow. It is a very useful tool for writers if they don't find it distracting, because it gives you an internal sense of pacing and timing. Mm. You know, if you're finding you've got so many words, you can't fit them to the rhythm, then often you're going, you know, you might be, your pacing might be a little slow. Very often fight scenes for me are composed to music. And I'll find, and that's one of the beauties where genre plays a role. So for example, oh God, this is a terrible thing to admit, but Farius Parfax, one of my favorite characters, I don't like the way that she fights, because she has not an ounce of meanness in her. She doesn't fight with a kind of aggression. She fights with a playfulness, with a dance in her. And so I will often, actually, even though I'm not a fan of country music, I'll listen to a country song when I'm setting the pace of her fighting, including, and this is the terrible admission, "Save a Horse, Ride a Cowboy" by Brooks and Dunn, which is the song by which at least one of her fight scenes was fully composed.
Genius. Absolutely. In fact, let's raise the bar just a touch, because I'm not sure whether, and you've brought a furry friend along to us as well. Sorry, I'm just saying for the non-radio listeners that Sebastian's been greeted by his mage, presumably, who's just sort of said hello. Would you like to name your feline friend's particular sort of incarnation? Who has chosen you, Sebastian, as
right.
your official soul?
This one, so we have two. One's called Suri, who is a black one. She got the name Suri, which actually means mouse in French, but from chauve-souris, which means bat, because when we got them, they were feral kittens, and she had been nearly starved to death. She had very little hair. She was this tiny little creature that, that weren't even sure was going to survive. And her ears looked so big in proportion to her body that we thought she looked like a bat. So she was called Suri. And as soon as she met us, like Scarlett O'Hara, she swore, I shall never go hungry again, and never did. And now it is a constant fight to keep her from getting too heavy. But both my cats have this weird thing. They absolutely love interviews. As soon as I'm on an interview, somehow they will make an appearance every single time.
It's a cameo thing. It's like Hitchcock, you know, the feline version of Alfred Hitchcock, making sure that they're actually in there. Well, having sorted out Suri's cameo role there, let's move on to another line, which, again, I can't recall whether we addressed this in your debut a couple of years ago. But Jessica, it's the sweet tea question. So would you like to actually quiz Sebastian on the sweet tea and possibly maybe raise the bar even further to the boiled peanut issue?
Oh, another level. We'd like to ask if they've heard of sweet tea or possibly boiled peanuts, which are the lifeblood of the South.
That's America, not Canada.
Yeah, yeah. Well, technically, I'm in the South of Canada, so I am, as a fellow Southerner.
Yes.
North of the 53rd parallel. I've heard of sweet tea, and I don't know what it is, and I have no idea why one boils a peanut.
Because it's delicious. You should try it. If you ever come to some of the small book festivals around the Carolinas, you will have to try sweet tea and boiled peanuts.
Well, one of my best friends and fellow writer and extremely talented writer by the name of Eric Torin moved to, I believe, South Carolina recently. And so, yes, get me on some book festivals, Jessica. I will come.
Yes.
I will come. I will do 17 book festivals quite happily. You'll have to make up new book festivals. Mm-hmm. High time we had the Sebastian de Castell Festival, I say.
Yeah. I think so.
I think that's agreed. Let's move back to, obviously, the Malevolent 7. And it's obviously available on ebook, print, and so on. Let's talk about the audiobook. How much of an input did you have in terms of the reader for the audiobook and in terms of the cast and line? Or is it a case of, no, I entrust that to the producers and they'll read the words in the order in which they were written?
I in fact specified it had to be Joe Jameson. And it's interesting. So when the Greatcoats were first going, or actually it was Spellslinger, when Spellslinger was first going to be an audiobook, because there hadn't been an audiobook at that point for the Greatcoats. They pitched me, the producers pitched me, three different narrators. And I used to work in the design field, and there's an old great design scam, which is when you have a client, you know, they always want to see three options. So you give them two terrible ones and the one you want them to pick. None of these were terrible, of course, but there was clearly the one they wanted me to pick. And I said, I don't know. I didn't quite dig the sound of it at the time. And then I went and listened to some of his other books that he'd done. And I said, okay, this is fantastic. Let's go with Joe. And since then, I've insisted he is the voice of all six Spellslinger books, all four Greatcoats books. He's the voice of half the short stories in the Tales of the Greatcoats collection. And he is the voice of the Malevolent Seven. And when you hear him do the voice of a goat man, you shall understand why there was none other but Joe Jameson who could be the narrator.
Sounds like an impressive rationale to me from that point of view. Jessica, any other closing thoughts you've got that you'd like to share with Sebastian or interrogatives you'd like to point his way?
I'd love to know if you were pointing someone to a book to start with from your collections, which would you choose?
Well, today I would definitely point them to Malevolent Seven because it is opening week, and one of the things you will discover, Jessica, when your debut novel comes out, is it's all about the first week. If you get on a bestseller list, then all of a sudden all the other bookstores order your book, and all of a sudden the lovely book festivals take an interest in you. And if your book can sell the same amount of copies over the course of a year as another book, but the book that sells a whole ton in that first week gets all the love and attention. So that's my mercenary, since it's a book about mercenary mages, that's my very mercenary attitude. Run out and buy Malevolent Seven. Make sure you buy yourself a spare copy just in case you spill tea on the first one or boiled peanuts. And also, you should probably buy a few copies for your friends. And the holidays are coming around. Why not buy one for every member of your family? Outside of
Exactly.
that, if someone's interested in sort of more young adult fiction, Way of the Argosy is a wonderful place to start. Ferus Parfax is quite possibly my favorite character I've ever written. I adore her. Or Spellslinger, which is Kellen, a young man. I find often people are sort of, you know, driven to sort of find themselves in books. So either of those choices is good. And if someone is more of an adult reader, doesn't sort of want YA and want some swearing in the first two pages, Traitor's Blade is also a perfectly acceptable choice, which harkens back to the swashbuckling adventures of, you know, Dumas and Sabatini and some of those greats, through my own, no doubt poorer interpretation.
I think we're clearly going to have to feature some of your work in one of our Book of the Month features for
Yes.
the service. But astonishingly, time has literally overtaken us. And let's hope it's not a gap of 2 years, because you probably forget the last two questions really on that basis. But it was 2 years ago when we last spoke. Jessica, would you like to put the final two questions, traditionally, of course, to Sebastian de Castell?
I would love to. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
Yes,
Big
this
question
was
one.
lovely. This is quite possibly my favorite interview. So, yeah, let's do this every week.
Yeah, well, that answers the second question. Will you join us again soon?
Absolutely. In fact, Fate of the Argosy, the third Argosy book with Ferus Parfax, is coming out in August. I shall anticipate an invitation, therefore, to come back on.
Clearly, and to that, of course, your two famous cats as well, who needs to have that cameo appearance for their next session with Siren Radio and Southside Broadcasting.
Exactly.
Sebastian de Castell, huge thanks. A reminder, of course, a best website to go to, presumably, would it be decastell.com, or would you say no? I do TikTok as well these days.
Oh God, you will never find me on TikTok. No, nothing against TikTok. I just can't figure it out. The there is a it's a foreign language to me. It's another culture to which I cannot seem to find a proper connection. Decastell.com is the best place to find me. I'm also on Twitter if you like. But I'm always happy. I reply to every piece of reader mail. So if you go to decastell.com and you go to the contact page, you will get a reply from me within a reasonable period of time.
merciless eyes I've deceived. I've seen angels fall from
through my